Over at the materials reprocessing station, Wedge and two helpers accidentally dropped a large section of crystal pipe, which crashed to the ground. Wedge shouted, and the others jumped out of the way to escape the fragments. At the construction site, the Vores fluttered up in the air in a panic, alarmed by the sound of breaking crystal. Quai put the flute to her mouth, taking a tentative breath. The smooth crystal felt cool against her thin blue lips. She blew into the unbroken end and held a finger over one of the holes, letting a test note whistle through the tube. She tried another and a third, gaining a feel for the songs the crystal flute could sing. She planted her feet among the crushed, glassy fragments on the ground, steadying herself against the blowing wind, and she played. It took her several tries to work the notes into the shapes she wanted, but she closed her large indigo eyes and let the music flow from her. The Vores flapped through the air, approaching her, circling overhead. Some landed in the whipping lavender grass nearby, turning their angular faces toward her, blinking horny eyelids over pupilless obsidian eyes. They listened. Quai thought of the destruction of the Cathedral of Winds, the loss of a great artifact and work of art, the deaths of so many Vores. The music took on a keening tone. In her mind, she also saw her own home planet of Amwat. When Moff Tarkin had placed her in an orbital training habitat as a child, so she and other talented Amwati children could watch as he destroyed their family's honeycomb settlements, if ever the children failed an examination. Music skirled out of the flute, rising and falling. She heard the flap of Vore wings over the sound of the notes in the wind. Quai blinked nervously and looked up at her silent audience, but she kept playing. From his position with the New Republic workers, Wedge came running over to see if she needed help. The other human engineers noticed the attention she had drawn. As Wedge approached, breathless and wide-eyed, Quai stopped playing. She took a deep breath and lowered her crystal flute. Surrounding her, the Vores did not speak. They stared at her, fluttering their wings to keep their balance. Segmented, leathery armor covered their faces, masking any readable expressions. She couldn't think of anything to say. A large male Vore, obviously a clan leader of some kind, stepped forward and extended his hand to take the flute from her. Still nervous, Quai placed the delicate instrument in his leathery palm. With a sudden violent gesture, the Vore squeezed his hand shut and crushed the flute. The thin crystal sides of the tube shattered. He opened his hand to let the fragments fall to the ground. Thin lines of blood blossomed on his palm. "No more music," he said. Her entire audience of Vores spread their wings and leaped into the winds, flying back over to the construction site. The leader kept his gaze on her. "Not until we are finished here," he said, and flew off to join the others. Stuck in hyperspace, Han Solo could do nothing but wait. He couldn't hurry the passage of time. He paced around the common area, looking at the battered holographic game board and thinking of when he had first seen R2-D2 playing with Chewbacca. That had been before he had even met Leia, when Luke Skywalker was a wet-behind-the-ears moisture farmer and Obi-Wan Kenobi was just a crazy old man. If he had known how his life would change after that day in the Mos Eisley Cantina, Han wondered if he would have taken the risk to pick up two passengers and their droids bound for Alderaan. But then he would never have met Leia, never have married her, never have fathered three children, never have helped defeat the Empire. Yes, he thought, despite all the turmoil, Han would make the same choices all over again. And now Leia was in great peril. Lando came from the cockpit. "She's on autopilot." He looked at the dejected expression on Han's face and shook his head. "Han, why don't you rest? Let's kill some time." Then, as if the idea had just occurred to him, "How about we play a round of sabacc?" Lando raised his eyebrows and flashed one of his famous grins. Han wondered if his friend was just trying to cheer him up and decided to see how serious Lando really was. "I'm not interested in sabacc right now." He sat down and lowered his voice. "I don't suppose you'd put up my ship as a stake." Lando scowled. "It's my ship, Han." Han leaned forward across the holographic chess table. "Not for long, buddy. Or are you afraid?" The Falcon shot through hyperspace on autopilot, oblivious to the fact that her ownership was being decided. Tiny pearls of sweat tickled the back of Hans' neck as he stared at his cards. Lando, who prided himself on a perfect bluffing expression, showed concern and uneasiness. For the third time in as many minutes, he wiped a hand across his brow. The scoring computer held them at 94 points each. The time now passed in a flash, and Han found himself so intent on the game that he had not thought about Leia's desperate situation for at least 15 seconds. "How do I know you don't have some trick programmed into these cards?" Lando said, staring at the aluminized plates, but holding the displays out of Han's line of sight. "You suggested this game, buddy. These were my old cards, but you degaussed them yourself. They're straight, no tricks." He let a smile creep across his lips. "And this time, there's no sudden change of rules during the final scoring round." Han waited a second longer, then impatiently took the initiative. "I'm keeping three cards," he said, and put two others face down in the center of the randomizer field. He pressed the scan button to change the value and suit on his cards, then slid them back out of the field to look at what he had drawn. Lando held out two cards and thought better of it, biting his lower lip, and pulled out a third. Han felt a wave of jubilation. Lando's hand was even worse than his own. Han's heart pounded. He had a flush of staves, a low flush with no face cards. But if he could beat Lando, this hand would give him enough points to pass the target score. Lando stared at his own cards, smiling a little bit, but Han thought it was forced. "Go on," Han said, and slipped his cards one at a time onto the platform. "Do I get extra points for having a completely random hand?" Lando said, then sighed. He put his elbows on the table and frowned. Han slapped a hand on his flush. "The Falcon's mine again." Lando smirked, as if losing the ship were a mixed blessing. "At least you're getting her back in better condition." Han clapped his friend on the back and with a light step danced back toward the cockpit. Slowly, with a sigh of satisfaction, he lowered himself back into the pilot's seat. Now, he thought, if he could just get to Leia in time, this would be a perfect day. 20. Kip Doran trudged through the dense rainforest of Yavin 4, trying to find hidden paths where the jungle would allow him to pass. He knew exactly where to go. The dark spirit of Exar Kun had shown him. With the stirring of the underbrush, reptilian predator birds burst squawking into flight, disturbed from the bloody carcass of a kill they had dragged into the canopy. Kip's assigned companion, Dorsk 81, stumbled beside him. The thin, smooth-skinned alien had a much more difficult time with the steamy air and the steep climbs. A purple-furred willamander clambered through the overhead network of Masasi trees. Dorsk 81 looked up, startled. But Kip had sensed the beast minutes before, feeling its primal panic and indecision build until finally it had to flee. Kip wiped sweat out of his eyes and shook his head, sending droplets of perspiration flying. He squinted again and moved forward with greater speed, knowing they had almost reached their destination, though Dorsk 81 had no idea yet. Insects and small biting creatures buzzed and scuttled around them, but none bothered Kip. He consciously exuded a shadow of uneasiness around him so that lower creatures had no incentive to come nearer. Exar Kun had taught him that trick, too. Dorsk 81 opened his lipless mouth, panting as he tried to keep up with the vigorous pace. His yellow and olive-green skin was unblemished, his nose flattened and smooth, his ears tucked back against his head, as if someone had designed his race in a wind tunnel. The alien looked miserable. His wide-set eyes blinked, and his face gleamed with a sheen of moisture. "I was not bred for this," Dorsk 81 said. Kip slowed, but not enough to bring relief to his companion. He softened the tone of his instinctive retort. "You were not bred for anything but bureaucracy and a comfortable life. I don't understand how the planet Kome could have survived unchanged for 1,000 years, or why your people wanted it to." Dorsk 81 took no offense and followed Kip. "Our society and our genetics reached their perfection a millennium ago. Or at least that's what we decided at the time. To prevent undesirable changes, we froze our culture at that level. We took our perfect race and cloned them rather than risking genetic anomalies. I am the 81st clone of Dorsk. 80 generations before me have been identical, doing the same jobs with the same level of skill, maintaining our level of perfection and not slipping back. Dorsk 81 frowned, and with a burst of surprising energy, he pushed around Kip. He flung himself into the effort of making a path through the dense brush with all the strength he possessed.
"But I was a failure," he said. "I was different."
Kip gestured to an identical-looking thicket of raven thorns, spotting the invisible maze of a relatively simple path.
"You have the potential to become a Jedi Knight," he said. "How can you consider that a failure?"
Dorsk 81 clawed his way out of the tangle he had become trapped in. Stains from crushed berries and flower petals dotted his uniform.
"It is unsettling to be different," he said.
Kip spoke partly to himself and partly to his companion.
"Yes, but sometimes it's exhilarating to know you can rise above the others who are trapped down below."
He ducked into the low tunnel of gloomy foliage and dangling mosses. Tiny gnats flew away from his face. The deep shadows suddenly made him think of the black spice mines of Kessel, where he had been forced to work as a slave.
"The Empire ruined my life," Kip said. "My parents were political resistors. They marked the anniversary of the Gorman massacre, and they protested the destruction of Alderaan. But by that time, the Emperor had lost all patience with political objections. Stormtroopers came in the middle of the night, battered their way into our home on the colony of Dyer. They took my parents, stunned them in front of our eyes, leaving them paralyzed and twitching on the floor. My father couldn't even close his eyes. Tears ran down his cheek, but his arms and his legs kept jittering. He couldn't get up. The stormtroopers dragged him and my mother out. My brother, Zeth, was 5 years older than me. They took him. He was only 14, I think. They put stun cuffs on his hands. They kicked him, pushed him out, and then they stunned me. I found out later that they took Zeth to the Imperial Military Academy on Corrida. They put my parents and me in the correctional facility on Kessel, where we had to work in the spice mines. I spent most of my days in pitch darkness because any light straying into the mine shafts spoiled spice crystals. My parents died there after only a few years. I had to take care of myself, even when the prisoners overthrew the correctional facility and took over. The crime lord there, Maruth Duel, tossed the captured Imperials down into the spice mines. Duel let some of the prisoners out, but not many, and not me. Our masters had changed, but we remained slaves.
Dorsk 81 looked at him with his glittering, wide-set eyes.
"How did you escape?" he said.
"Han Solo rescued me," Kip answered.
Warmth filtered into his voice.
"We stole a shuttle and fled into the black hole cluster. There we stumbled upon a secret Imperial research installation, and we were captured again, this time by Admiral Dalla and her fleet of star destroyers. Han got us out of there after Dalla had placed a death sentence on me."
Anger curled through him, making his head buzz, making him feel stronger. He tapped into that strength.
"You can understand why the Imperials make me so furious," he said. "It seems that every step of my life, the Empire has tried to beat me into submission, tried to take away the rights and pleasures that other life forms enjoy."
"You can't fight the Empire alone," Dorsk 81 said. Kip didn't answer for a long moment.
"Perhaps not yet," he said.
Before Dorsk 81 could say anything, Kip parted a dense clump of blue leaf branches. He felt an electric thrill down his spine, as if the Force told him they had arrived.
"This," Kip whispered, "this is our destination."
In front of them, the jungle gave way to a circular pond that shone like a flat quicksilver mirror, completely free of ripples. In the center of the lake stood a small island dominated by an obsidian split pyramid of sharp angles, showing the distinctive markings of Masasi architecture. Another temple, the same one Gantaris and Streen had located weeks before, but Luke Skywalker had not yet explored it. Exar Kun had told Kip all about it. Between the bifurcated spire of the tall pyramid stood a colossus, a polished black statue of a dark man with long hair swept back behind him, the tattoo of a black sun emblazoned on his forehead, and the padded garments of an ancient lord. the Dark Lord of the Sith. End of Side 4, Chainside Selector Switch. This book is continued on the next cassette.